You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
people who made that prediction were either badly misinformed or lying to the American public. It does explain, however, why they continue to resurface six-month-old news stories to try to justify their opposition to an agreement that has benefited the American people.
Not for the first time in U.S. history, the White House denies that anything weird has been going on in its dealings with Tehran. My guests Martin Sandboo and Sir William Patey will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
The Bank of England continues to stand ready to take whatever action is needed to achieve its objectives for monetary and financial stability as the UK adjusts to new realities.
The Bank of England cuts UK interest rates still further amid gloomy post-referendum economic prognostications. But will it work? Why are so many heads of government and or state RSVPing in the negative for tomorrow night's Olympic opening ceremony in Rio? And what do you do when your tourist attraction is attracting too many tourists? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Martin Sandboo, economics writer of Martin Sandboo's Free Lunch at the Financial Times, and Sir William Patey, international affairs advisor with Control Risks, former UK ambassador to Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq and Saudi Arabia. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with the presidential election in the US, one of whose contestants is proving such a bountiful source of bizarre headlines that stories which would be big news in a sane campaign are languishing somewhat unnoticed. One such is the payment of $400 million US in cash to Iran by the US government very shortly, some are saying suspiciously shortly, after the release of five US citizens, including Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, detained by the Islamic Republic. Yesterday, White House Press Secretary, easy for me to say, Josh Earnest, answered questions on the topic thus.
Was this money ransom for the folks that were released?
No. It was not. It is against the policy of the United States to pay ransom for hostages. Mike, again, we talked about this in January, too, so let's talk about this. There was a conscious strategic decision that was made on the part of the Obama administration as we were implementing the deal to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon to resolve other longstanding concerns that we had with Iran. And that included securing the release of five American citizens who'd been unjustly detained in Iran, and closing out a long-standing financial dispute in a way that saved the American people potentially billions of dollars. So this all came to a head at the same time because we are addressing and resolving long-standing concerns with Iranian behavior. And the benefits are almost too long to mention, but the highlights are Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. Iran had to scale back significant aspects of their nuclear program. Iran released five Americans who were unjustly detained on Iranian soil. And we resolved a 35-year-old financial claim with the Iranians in a way that saved Americans potentially billions of dollars. There are many other benefits we can get into as well, but those are the highlights.
Josh Earnest, speaking for the Obama administration, denying that the $400 million was a ransom. But William, putting $400 million in cash on an aeroplane looks a bit like the sort of thing you would do if you were paying a ransom, doesn't it? I'm not an expert. I have never paid how many figures is that? Nine-figure ransom. But I imagine the procedure would be something of the sort.
I think most ransoms that are paid much more surreptitiously than that, than sticking them on a plane. I mean, I think there's a piece of diplomacy going on here. They were obviously, you know, when you're dealing with Iran, you're having to negotiate all sorts of things. People forget that some Iranians were released at the same time as the five Americans were. So that was, you know, part of the deal. And you could see in the post-Iran nuclear deal, when assets were going to be released anyway, why the Americans wouldn't throw this into the mix. Because part of the nuclear deal was that frozen Iranian assets are to be released anyway. So there's a much larger sum of assets to be released other than the $400 million.
This is the line, of course, Martin, not just the $400 million, but $1.3 billion in accrued interest, which was apparently dispatched to Tehran by more orthodox methods, PayPal possibly. I don't know how these things work. But yes, it was a prisoner exchange. There were Iranians being held in the US for sanctions violations. This was money from Iranian funds frozen since 1981. Is it in fact then basically a reasonably honest and straightforward bit of business as the White House are claiming?
Well, I think diplomacy is usually a much bigger game than reasonable and honest deals, but it's politics and diplomacy. As Will says, it's part of a much, much, much bigger and more important deal. I mean, from what I've read about the deal, it seemed like the Iranians had somewhat of a decent claim. I think this was money that they had paid to the U.S. before the revolution
and this was
a weapons purchase, and they never got the weapons because the revolution happened.
This was a claim they did lodge successfully with the U.S. Claims Tribunal in The Hague. It was they haven't been holding America either literally or figuratively out of a window by their ankles.
Let's just put it this way, that the troubles in the relationship between the U.S. and Iran are much, much bigger than this. This is at most a minor irritant, but it made perfect sense to get it out of the way at the same time. I do think that the money arrived on the same day as some of the hostages were released, or the prisoners were released, and clearly that was used for propaganda on the Iranian side, but that's kind of inevitable. Really.
Well, those of us with memories stretching back to 1980 can, of course, remember a previous strange confluence of hostages being released and deals being done with the United States. That being the case, William, the Republicans are desperate to try and get some air into this. Are they, at least with that cohort of voters who can remember Iran-Contra, on slightly thin ice here?
I think they're on pretty thin ice. I mean, if you're going to pay ransoms with the hostage takers' money, that seems like a good deal, really. It was Iranian money. Even the Americans don't dispute this. So, as I say, it's a long-running sore, which would have been had to be resolved by other means. So if you can throw something in, that it's a giveaway, frankly. It's money the Iranians... It's Iranian money. The Americans know it's Iranian money. If it's part of the overall negotiation, why not do it? I think it's Republican desperation. They don't like the nuclear deal. They don't like any improvement in relations with Iran. And I think they're clutching at straws here.
Martin, on that thought, the Republicans not liking the nuclear deal, is it that they don't like the nuclear deal or they don't like the president who concluded it?
Well, I think it's both, but I think there is a legitimate skepticism in some quarters about the deal. I think the deal is probably quite a bold diplomatic step that we hope will have positive effects, but I think it's entirely fair to distrust the Iranian side and think that too much was given up here. On the other side, the Obama administration will say there was no alternative. But I think that's really the issue that the serious people in the Republican Party are kind of trying to revive. It's not really about the ransom. It's about, should we be trusting these sorts of countries? I mean, on the ransom point, we could remember that the Republican candidate ransoms the U.S.'s own allies. He says they have to pay up before he's going to defend them.
A not unreasonable point. A final thought on this story, William. You've served as ambassador in a couple of adjacent countries to Iran. American-Iranian relations do seem like a massive piece of unfinished geopolitical business. How far are we, do you think, from the day, and it will come, on which Air Force One touches down at Imam Khomeini Airport or the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran is welcomed to the White House?
I'd be reasonably confident in saying that it won't be President Clinton or President Trump who's on that plane, and that allows for two terms. I think we're quite a way away from normalized relationship with the U.S. Yes, because if you look at even the nuclear deal, which is was many years in the making, you're still left with the U.S. imposing its sanctions remain on Iran. So these are UN and EU sanctions that have been lifted. It's U.S. sanctions remain for a host of other reasons. Because of Iran's support for terrorist organizations, for the interference in Syria, in Lebanon, in Iraq, and elsewhere. So fundamental U.S.-Iranian relations have not warmed a great deal. And as Martin says, we've got a long way to go on the nuclear deal. The Iranians might argue that the Americans are skeptical. They themselves are skeptical because some of the economic benefits haven't really come their way. So that's not a given that will survive.
Okay, well, let's look now at the UK, where the post-EU referendum taking back control continues, in as much as after you set your own house ablaze, you can control where you point the extinguisher first. In a widely anticipated manoeuvre, the Bank of England has today cut interest rates from an already low 0.5% to a barely visible 0.25%. Here is the Bank of England Governor, Mark Carney, explaining himself.
Today's announcement is the latest element of the bank's joined-up policy response to the referendum. A plan that was based on months of extensive analysis of the risks, detailed planning, and appropriate public communications. A plan that delivered a broad range of contingency measures to contain the immediate impact on the financial system of the result of the referendum. A plan that's already expanded the amount of credit available to the real economy. And now a plan that delivers a timely, coherent, and comprehensive monetary policy response that lowers the cost of credit and improves financial conditions for households and businesses across a wide range of channels. The Bank of England continues to stand ready to take whatever action is needed to achieve its objectives for monetary and financial stability as the UK adjusts to new realities and moves forward to seize new opportunities outside the European Union.
Mark Carney there, Governor of the Bank of England. Martin Sanbu, first of all, and you're going to need to pretend here that you are addressing a complete financial idiot who cannot conduct a five-minute conversation with his own accountant without bursting into fat, pea-sized tears of boredom. But how drastic actually is this? Because on the one hand, 0.5% down to 0.25% doesn't sound like that big a deal. On the other hand, he's just cut the base rate by half.
I think you need to start by trying to look at what it is the Bank of England can do and is trying to do. So the vote to leave the EU hits the economy in two quite different ways. One is that it erodes over time the productivity of the UK economy relative to the growth you could have had because of uncertainty, because trade relations will be torn up and so on. That's the supply side, how much the economy can produce. Then there's an immediate bigger hit to the demand side. How much are people willing to buy? Are they willing to spend on goods and services which will keep people employed? The Bank of England can try to push up the demand side so that it at least employs people and capital fully. But in the long term, and Mark Carney was explicit about this, there's only so much monetary policy can do. It sort of can try to limit the immediate damage. So how drastic is this? Yeah, it's only a quarter point cut, which doesn't sound very much, but they don't have very much longer to go, and they don't want to go below zero, unlike some countries, and so they want to keep a little bit of powder dry. But they did some other things. They said that they're going to buy a lot of more government and corporate bonds.
£60 billion of government bonds, £10 billion worth of corporate bonds, £70 billion, which even I can tell is a very great deal of money. What measurable impact does that have on a national economy, though?
Well, the Bank of England itself, when it did this before, estimated that, you know, if you compare like for like the proportional numbers, this sort of bond purchase program could be equivalent to maybe a whole point cut in interest rates. So if you put the two together, we're talking about 1.25, maybe 1.5. So imagine, think back to normal times before the crisis. It would never have happened that the bank would cut the rate by so much in one session. So compared to that, it is quite a big move.
William, do you think that the rate cut in and of itself is the kind of thing that makes enough of a difference to ordinary people's lives that they're inspired to go out and spend enough to reinvigorate the economy? It says here that it's £22 a month off a typical mortgage. And, you know, £22 is £22, but this is not life-transforming sums of money for most people.
No, and I think that that's part of the problem. Is some of the instruments that the bank has to play with are not there because, you know, they used to have interest rates at 4 or 5% base rates, and that was gave them plenty scope. So, but there's not much they can do. Mark Carney predicted that the Brexit would mean a big hit for the economy, i.e. we'd be producing less, we would be poorer, and this is an attempt to inject some sort of spending power into the economy so that people will buy stuff and businesses will be able to keep employing people. And, you know, it's a kind of anti-austerity, but it's not going to make a huge difference. Given the uncertainty around Brexit, 22 quid a month is not going to make anybody feel suddenly very much richer and change their calculation. Of course, the other measures of pumping extra money into the economy are all designed to do similar things. And you've got other people advocating government borrowing money to invest in the economy. These are all the same sort. They're all measures contributing to how do you overcome the post-Brexit decline in our economy and how do you stimulate it? But the bank has not many levers left.
It won't do any harm, but I think it's a bit bigger than it might sound when you say £22 a month. I mean, that is only the quarter point cut. There are all these other measures that will also improve credit conditions for companies and households. Even £22 a month, that's what, 260 a year?
Think
about the numbers. An average earner would need to make £400 more a year before tax to have that to spend. That's about a 5% pay rise for an average earner, or 4 or 5%. If you got a 5% pay rise, you'd probably feel good about spending a little bit more.
Yeah, you do make a fair point. But is that not offset, though, by the damage this does to people who save money? Because savings accounts in this country are becoming rapidly worthless.
It's true, but I think monetary policy, when it's loosened, normally works by redistributing income from savers to borrowers. Savers, you know, tend to spend less of their marginal income than borrowers do. That's how they got to be savers and net creditors. So the presumption is that shifting, yeah, it's bad for those who rely on their interest income. But for the economy as a whole, it'll probably be a boost, maybe probably bigger than what it sounds like. But I agree, certainly much less than the damage that's been done by the referendum.
William, as a professional reader of governmental runes, usually of, I guess, those of foreign governments, what have you made of how the British government has responded in the weeks since the referendum? Just wondering whether you think that the economic picture might improve the clearer it becomes that this government, at least, is determined to kick Article 50 into extremely long grass for quite some considerable time.
Well, except that prolongs the uncertainty, if you like, because, you know, we know we're going. Theresa May hasn't backtracked on that, even though I would like her to do so. But so you've got a period of reflection, which is very sensible. Negotiations are not going to start till the end of the year, although there'll be some bilaterals going on. But then you've got 2 years of not knowing what the deal is. And so that's 2.5 years of uncertainty. And that's going to make business people hesitate. They're going to worry about investment. It's going to have an impact. It's the uncertainty that's having the impact. If at the end of the day, and people like me are going to be arguing right up to the last minute that there's time for a rethink.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Martin Sanbu and William Patey. Coming up next, what if they gave an opening ceremony and nobody came?
Monocle rather likes being left on the shelf. Well, the bookshelf. In partnership with our friends at Publishers Gestalten in Berlin, we're creating a library of exciting, desirable and very useful books. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living, the inspiring Monocle Guide to Good Business, and also the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes. Then there's our growing line of city guide books that includes Rio de Janeiro, New York, Tokyo, Madrid, Hong Kong, and Bangkok, with 10 new guides to be added in 2016 alone. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. Buy our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com or find them on the shelves of all great bookstores.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Martin Sanbu and Sir William Patey. Now, a little over 24 hours from now, roughly 80,000 people will be packed into the Maracana Stadium for the opening ceremony of the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. Conspicuously not among them will be a solid couple of dozen heads of state, heads of government and other panjandrums who have found something better to do with their evening. More than 50 were expected as recently as last week, but at last count, only 28 are expected expected to actually show up. William, I'm always fascinated by the diplomatic subtexts and maneuverings behind such things. If you are a country holding an Olympic Games, which of course this one was 4 years ago right now, would you regard these no-shows as snubs, or just, you just accept that things come up, people are busy, it's a long way to travel, etc.? What is the reaction when people say, actually, I'm not coming after all?
Well, I think if you're the host government, you're too busy worrying about making a success of the event to worry. I mean, the trouble with Olympics is they're not like other, they're not like funerals, for instance, where state funerals are really good occasions for networking with your fellow leaders. So going to a funeral, state funeral, is an important statement of your support for the country or the leader. But even if it isn't, it's an opportunity to network. And I think Olympics are not brilliant opportunities to network. Brazil is a long way away. It's been bedeviled by all sorts of problems, of infrastructure problems, and the Zika virus. And given the state of the world, it could be that lots of leaders are just, in August, busier than they usually are.
Well, why are funerals so much better than Olympic Games for networking? I mean, I'm thinking now of you may or may not have read it, there is a glorious section in Paddy Ashdown's diaries where he recalls attending the funeral of King Hussein of Jordan, which, as you can imagine, becomes an extraordinary opportunity to meet absolutely everybody. But why funerals rather than Olympic Games?
Well, they're unplanned, for a start.
And well, so usually.
Yeah, usually unplanned. And so there's usually kind of, and they're obligatory in many ways. So you've got to go. And there is an opportunity. There's nothing much else to do at the funeral, so you're all pushed together. So there is an opportunity to network. Whereas I think Olympics, people are torn. If you're the head of state in a particular country, you're off to see. If you're big in judo, you're off to see judo. If you're big in handball, you're kind of torn all over the city. So it's not such a great networking opportunity.
Martin and Orr, how much is this to do with the fact that there's a possible reluctance among global leaders to be photographed shaking hands with Brazilian politicians right now? Just before we came on air, in fact, in the last hour, it's been confirmed that Dilma Rousseff, the suspended current president, will be tried by a full Senate impeachment. Are people going to be worried that any sort of photo opportunities you turn up for might come back to haunt you at this point?
Well, it'll certainly look a bit awkward, won't it? I mean, you have to feel a bit sad for Brazil here, because think about the Olympics. The Games have always been about the organizing country putting itself on display, showing its prowess. And in the last couple of, well, last decade, pretty much, it's also been where the big emerging economies have burst onto, you know, sort of announced their arrival on the world stage. Think about China's Olympics. Think about the World Cup in South Africa or something similar. Brazil, of course, had the World Cup, which actually went better than expected, except for their actual football. So this was going to be a huge opportunity. And, you know, they might not be all that linked, but they kind of go together and tell the narrative that a country doesn't want to be telling about itself. The politics is in a shambles at best. The Games look a little bit shambolic as well.
I mean, I think it's, Martin said on something that's quite telling at the moment, is the BRICS were all the coming nations, and we had the Olympics in China, and we had the World Cup in South Africa and Brazil. So there was going to be, you know, some of the shine has gone off the BRICS, and I think in Brazil in particular has come a long way down from it being the future. The policies of the status policies of Dilma Rousseff have been pretty catastrophic for the Brazilian economy. So it's a country that's in a real crisis, and you know whether that's having an impact on whether the leaders go or not. But as you say, you've got an interim president there who may or may not be there for very long. So it's not a must-go. It's not a must-go event.
But on that thought, from the diplomatic perspective, if you've announced that you're going to go to an Olympics and you decide for one whatever reason or another that you're not going to, what's a plausible, appropriate excuse?
Well, in our case, the Prime Minister's changed and our country's just made a life-changing decision. So we're well covered.
So the UK's off the hook.
Pretty good. I mean, I suppose Obama is, you know, well, why should I go? I'm the outgoing president. You don't want to see me anyway, and I'm in the middle of a big election campaign. Everyone will have a plausible excuse, that's for sure.
And I suppose that's the advantage of doing a job like running a country. There's always something, isn't there?
There certainly is. And given where we are in the world, you know, there's a lot going on. August is usually a time when we can relax, but there's no relaxation at the moment.
Well, I'm not sure sure that you need an excuse, really. I mean, who's there to be offended? It's not even clear who's
charged. Well, the fact of it being August and a time when people go away does move us seamlessly along to our last item tonight. Cities and countries all over the world, of course, go to extraordinary lengths to attract tourists, and understandably so, because tourists do spend vastly more money than they need spending on them. However, while a big city like London, Paris, New York, or indeed Rio can stand a summer of slightly more overcrowded trains easily enough, at what point should a quieter and more remote location hang out the no vacancy sign? Norway's Lofoten Islands, and apologies for the fact that I've almost certainly mispronounced that, recently beloved of Hollywood directors for their fairy tale beauty, are now complaining of being overrun. Martin, 24,000 or so people live on these islands. They got more than a million visitors last summer. Do the beleaguered islanders have a point?
I don't know if I've told you this, but I'm actually from Norway, so I have, you know, a special kind of sympathy.
We were aware of this.
And it's pronounced Lofoten, the Lofoten Islands.
I was right that I was wrong.
Very
That's
good.
That's something.
A million tourists is huge. But I think this sort of nicely illustrates the rivalry, if you like, between the two top desires of the Norwegian people, one of which is to be extremely popular with the rest of the world, and the other is to be left in peace. And it's, you know, it sort of goes back and forth which one comes out on top. No Norwegian municipality kind of desperately needs a million tourists to save its economy. Norway is kind of a pretty good place to live, materially speaking, no matter where you go. Let's not talk about the weather. This place is stunningly beautiful. It probably is a bit too much. What I have seen is that the neighbouring municipalities aren't. It seems like all the tourists are going to one place. But actually, you know, it's quite pretty next door as well. So I think some of the neighbouring municipalities are trying to say, look, let's take some of this burden off your shoulders.
William, is there ever a case, do you think, for passing restrictions? There are places that do. Bhutan famously has a quota, I think I'm right in saying, on tourists. Arunachal Pradesh in northeastern India, at least when I went there many years ago, restricts tourists and charges them fortunes to go. Is there an argument for it?
And not the Oman, for instance, has deliberately over many years taken a policy of restricting tourist visas and only encouraging the highest spending tourists to preserve the pristine climate and reduce the impact on its culture. It's perfectly normal. And smart places would do the same. If you look at Spain is now beginning to regret the mass market tourism that it had and trying to row it back a bit. So it's a perfectly legitimate policy of trying to preserve what people are coming to see and restricting the numbers. I recently went to the Galapagos Islands mainly because I thought they were about to restrict the numbers who could go in order to preserve it, and I better go before they shut the doors. So it's, I think it's perfectly legitimate. As Martin says, the Norwegians don't need the money, so they could certainly, if the numbers were threatening the environment and the enjoyment, you'd be well advised to restrict them.
Of course, it's only the highest spending tourists who can afford to go to Norway in the first place. But the problem is the localization of it, right? It's not as if it's too many tourists for Norway as a whole, but this is a very small place. And that's kind of tricky in an open society. How do you restrict access to one place inside the country, especially a place like Norway that has very long traditions of open access to nature, even private land, you can't deny people access to it, and so on. So it's tough.
So, but well, help the islanders out. Where else in Norway should people go instead? Because Norway is, as you were saying, a beautiful, beautiful country. What's the bit that isn't being overrun by tourists yet?
Oh, I think you can go pretty much anywhere along the coast. And of course, most of Norway is coast. So take out the map, pick a spot and go there.
It is one of those weird things, isn't it? It's the equivalent of sitting in a traffic jam complaining about traffic. It's like you go places as a tourist and then complain that there's tourists.
Well, that's a classic. I've done it myself. You know, you go to a place, this place is really lovely, if it wouldn't be for all the other people who are there. You want it to yourself. But it will self-correct, because if people have gone to see the wilderness and gone for the... they won't go again if there's a million other people there with them.
You did want some practical advice, didn't you? There is a coastal express that goes all the way from Bergen up to the North Cape, and you can stop in lots of places in between. So check that out and look at the route.
A journey I have always fancied, and now that I do go and do it, it will, of course, because people have just heard your recommendation, I won't be able to get a seat. Thanks a lot. Martin Sandbu and Sir William Patey, thank you very much both for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jimena Minyan. Our studio manager was George
George McDonough. There's music next, 1900 The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, though, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.